The following programming is sponsored by MBC Media. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
Mad Dog Mattis. You ever heard that name? He's a Marine general, nicknamed Mad Dog, of course. He wrote a book I want to tell you about. It's called Call Sign Chaos. It's an incredible story that's going to tie together everything we talked about for the past 7 weeks. I'll go through that Mad Dog Mattis story with you, but I got some other big news as well. My book, Victory Over Chaos, is now available, and I brought on a special guest who read the pre-release draft, one of only three people, and who was there at Kafji with me. So he can give you his review of the book as well as some of his firsthand account at what happened there. When we come back for the third segment, I got a special treat here for you. You probably heard me talking about this. Really epic for me. If you've heard of the book and movie Flags of Our Fathers, then you know that this is the story about Iwo Jima made into a movie, Clint Eastwood, a lot of big stuff. You know about the Iwo Jima statue. Well, anyway, of those guys that were on Iwo Jima, do you know that only three came back alive? Isn't that amazing? Most people don't even know that. Well, I was fortunate enough to interview the son of one of those three men, James Bradley, who's the author of Flags of Our Father. And I'm going to tell you, when you hear that segment from the interview, we interviewed him for over an hour, and I pulled out 10 of the most exciting minutes of that to share with you here on the radio today. That interview, like everything we're doing here, is absolutely epic. He talks about his father, the fighting, the brutality, the flag raising. It's all incredible. Then he talks about Steven Spielberg buying the rights to the movie, meeting Clint Eastwood on Iceland to make the film, and I kid you not, cornering George Bush Sr. in the head. Wait till you hear what he said about all that. This is Project Chaos. We're here live from Philadelphia, 860 AM, WWDB Radio. I'm Chris Kunkel, your host and author of my newest book, Victory Over Chaos. You can check it out at projectchaos.org. I want to talk a little bit about this Mad Dog Mattis book here for a couple of minutes. A fantastic book. I'm always amazed when I start talking about it how many people have also read it. Very, very popular book. I don't know whose publicist this is. Maybe we should track that down, and maybe our Victory Over Chaos would be a nice sequel to that. But either way, I got a hold of this book. I think it was a gift from my wife or a friend or something like that, and finally went away on a little trip. I got an opportunity to crack it open. I couldn't put the thing down. You ever get that where you open a book and you think, man, I don't want to finish it? I hope Dave is going to say the same thing about my book, but we're talking about Call Sign Chaos right now, and I highly recommend it. Let me just say this to you. If you have the time, and even if you're not interested in war stories and war fighting, still a really great book. Let me tell you a couple things that he talked about in there, because I think it's interesting to know, helpful information for military veterans, but civilians alike. The first thing I want to tell you, that Mad Dog Mattis was a fighter. He tells his stories, talks about getting arrested at a young age, getting the fist fights. And why do I bring all that up? Not so much to brag. Some people might have bragging rights to that. But I say this to you. I've talked about other generals and things over the past weeks on the show here that would, you know, in some very high levels, and they weren't afraid to go to fisticuffs. These were men who liked to fight, wanted to fight. And Mad Dog Mattis is one of those. And I can kind of relate. And I think as we talk through this a little bit more, you're going to see that for the Marine combat units, there's a bit of a desire to get into fights, and he certainly had that, I guess is my point about all that. But he had a very interesting leadership style, and he had some incredible leadership methods that this guy was no slacker. This wasn't something that you read out of your, junior-level college class. This guy read a lot, thought a lot, and really remarkable what he was doing in terms of his personnel management, also his warfighting style. I want to talk to you a little bit about this warfighting style from this perspective. As I read what he wrote in there, I was very impressed. I'm going to share some of it with you, the Afghanistan strike in particular. But I would love to know what General Mattis would have to say about this force redesign 2030 and the taking away of Army and artillery from the Marine Corps. I'm going to tell you right now, his style that was so incredibly effective for decades is not at all what the Marine Corps and the military is doing today. Why? Why? He had brought a self-contained package of amphibious warfare, talked about it, documented how powerful that is, and I'm going to tell you more about it. He went into it in detail. Why would we ignore that? Why would we ignore what this guy has to say? But we are, and it's history repeating itself. If I have time, I'll try to tie that in with the interview with James Bradley and what it all means to Iwo Jima. Let me tell you a little bit about this a second, because there's a lot you can take away from this. This is the what I call the Afghanistan strike story from call sign Chaos. Basically, it gets the call that we're going to attack Afghanistan. And it was going to be an Army Air Force operation. Mattis goes and lobbies to get the Marines into the fight. He wanted to be into the fight. It was important to him. Why? Because he knew he had the capabilities he could deliver for the Americans in Afghanistan. And very simply, what he provided was the tip of the spear. You probably heard that saying before. What specifically am I talking about? A rapid deployment MEU, a rapid deployment Marine Expeditionary Unit. You probably heard me mention this over the weeks leading up to this, how important this is to our military. The rapid deployable MEUs, the Marine Expeditionary Units, are as critical as any piece of equipment, any other structure that we have, but yet it's being torn apart. These Marine Expeditionary Units pride themselves on what? Completely self-contained, combined arms operation. Marine air power, Marine artillery, Marine armor. In the case of the Afghanistan strike, it wasn't an amphibious landing at all. They flew this team of Marines, if you can imagine this a second. They come off of a ship out in the Mediterranean, the Gulf, or wherever they were, and they fly. I would imagine these were fixed-wing aircraft to get this far, but it was about a 400-mile strike. If you listen carefully, you heard me talking a couple of shows back. I talked about the maritime prepositioning systems and the fact that we could put a regiment on a beachhead, like literally within 24 hours anywhere on the world. Very powerful, but it'd be limited to landing on the beachhead. Mattis takes this whole setup, this combined arms approach that we were all part of, and he says, I can make it even more mobile. And he develops this plan to take this Marine Expeditionary Unit deep inside of Afghanistan. Who cares, right? This is like military stuff for military guys. Let me tell you why you should care. The country of Afghanistan was in disarray, and we wanted to take control of it. Whether you agree with any of the politics around that or not, it doesn't really matter. The job of the military was to take control of the country. Well, it's a big country. It's spread out, mountains. It's not like you just, you know, a drive across the country would take forever. How do you quickly establish dominance in a country like that? Well, this is how they did it. They fly off of the ship, and they drop in. They've got, I don't know, probably a couple hundred Marines, call it. Not a huge force at all. What makes that so formidable? They set up a fire base. They've got artillery fire support. What did they just do? They just sent a message that anybody that comes within about 20 miles of that fire base is going to be dead. And so Mattis was able to go into Afghanistan, deep in, drop in this self-contained combined arms unit, completely self-contained, able to provide their own security in every way, 400 miles inside of the country. That forward operating base is what cleared the way for forces to come in and meet with them, and you had this incredibly aggressive pace that they were able to take the country. Amazing capability. Now we've taken away with them. Now, the thing for Mattis that I'll have to say in reading the book, and one of the things that I really enjoyed, was that this was a guy who really knew how to navigate the politics. He talked about it in depth, all the shenanigans that you see going on, all the problems. He dealt with all that stuff. He talks about his frustrations with it, how foolishly the political class can think at times, how difficult it can be to work with the other branches. He didn't necessarily talk about it exactly in those terms, but my point is this is a guy that knew how to grease the wheels. He knew how to get things done. I want to share with you a couple of things that were his ethos, if you will, that I think, like I said, it's good for Marine units, it's good for non-Marine units, good for work unit too. He said that recruit for attitude and train for skill. How many people do that today? I don't think many at all. Most companies that put up a job posting want to see the qualifications, not even looking into the attitude of the person they're dealing with. It's backwards. Mattison knew that he wanted tenacity in that environment. Now, you may not want tenacity, depending on the area that you're working in, but for the Marine Corps, it's very important. You know, when the back gate of the helicopter drops, everybody off now, not wait until you figure it out, all right? So everything has to move. He wanted that tenacity. Whatever it is, you need to hire for that, and you'd be surprised with the responses. He said, if you want an elite force, selection is critical. Like any organization, the Marine Corps has to recruit and get the talent it needs. He said in the mid-1970s, he served his first two tours on recruiting duty. This is like a sales job for the Marine Corps. Talks about how he had to manage across these large areas and that he had to have the very decentralized management approach. And as I hear all the complaints in the workforce today, I said, man, there's a lot of management people that need to read this book, understand how to properly lead people. He said something else that I've talked about before, and I firmly believe that he's correct on this. He said, Marines believe that attitude is a weapon system. Our minds are our weapon. He said he searched for intangible character traits, a quest for adventure, a desire to serve with the elite, and the intention to be in top physical condition. All these things, and you find in these Marine units, they want people that are self-starters. You know, you see all the imagery of boot camp and the drill instructors yelling, but once you get out into the fleet, it's a little bit different. They want people that are going to do it on their own. They don't have to be told to do it. And that's what he was looking for. He said he hated some of the tasks that came with the Marine Corps, like crawling through minefields, but he reveled in the camaraderie of men crawling through them, biting their lip the whole time. I read that and I thought, wow, there was things that General Mattis didn't like to do in the Marine Corps. And I found that very fascinating because I didn't have that experience at all. My brother's coming on here. I'm sure he'll tell you. I never complained, not once. And I didn't even have to bite my lip because I loved every minute of it. Dave's going to share that with you, I think. But there's a couple of points that I did take away from Mattis's book that I was a little upset by. And I say this because it wasn't what he did write that I was a little upset by. It was what he didn't write. And the first thing is it became clear to me, and these are my words, not his words, but he sure seemed to me that he had a strong desire that he wanted to continue the global war on terror. General Mattis is no Smedley Butler, let's put it that way. He wanted to keep up the fight. The other thing that bothered me in his book, he talks about deploying the Desert Storm, and if we can here today, I'm hoping we have a couple minutes to get to this. But I think I deployed with his Marines on our advance party. It's a fascinating story, really. But he never mentioned Kafji, and he had an opportunity there that he could have revealed the truth about that. He did nothing. The third story that really bothered me, and I don't want to get too into it today because I get a little upset, but we're going to talk about it one day, and that's the Haditha Dam story, the Haditha massacre. And I don't know, maybe Mattis did save those Marines, but he didn't vindicate them. And I'm going to tell you right now, whatever you've heard about Haditha, it was a leadership failure. Not a failure of the Marines on the ground. We'll talk about that another day. But those are the three things that bug me a little bit about Mattis's book. But it turns out that I do have this crazy connection to Mattis. And I knew there was a reason, but I never really was able to focus on this. So let me tell you the story real quick. And I didn't know this until I was going back and doing research for this. I put it all together. By early 1990, Mattis was commanding 1-7, the 1st Marine Regiment, 1-7, Marines of 1-7. So it was a humbling assignment, and the military unit legacies matter, and this battalion had a proud legacy indeed. The renowned Chesty Puller had commanded 1-7 in the epic World War II Battle of Guadalcanal. In the Korean War, Ray Davis had earned the Medal of Honor, leading my battalion in its critical fight at the Frozen Chosen Reservoir, freeing the 1st Marine Division from the Chinese communist trap. Listen, I can tell you firsthand that these legacies are taken very, very seriously. What does that mean in simple terms? When you show up, you know what the saying was? You joined us. We didn't join you. You're going to come in and measure to our standards, not the way the other way around. He said the unit typically adopts to the personality of the commander, and he took that all seriously. And he put in place certain things to make sure that he was getting the personality that he wanted. But I want to make this point. It was very hard training regimen that he explained leading up to this point. This is early 1990s explaining what he was doing. I was in Okinawa, Japan at the time that he's speaking of here. We're getting ready to go back to Hawaii. Very similar situation. But my point is that he talked about how hard the unit was training. He's in 1-7 out on the West Coast, California, training hard with 1-7 infantry unit. Well, here we are, 1-12, halfway around the world in Okinawa, and guess what we're doing? Training pretty doggone hard. It was a really an aggressive training cycle. Then what happened? Well, he's talking about the story. I hope I get it right here. He's out at 29 Palms in the middle of a training exercise. If you're a Marine, you've ever been in the field, you know what this would be like. They're out there training out in the field, going through their thing. They get a call. I need you back. You guys got to go. What? We're out here training. All the gear's got to be. There's a lot to embark on a deployment. And he talks about how quickly it all had to happen. What was going on? He was leaving for the Gulf War. He talks about how he sent Marines from 1-7, this legendary unit. He sent Marines from part of that MU that he sent out advance party. I was on that advance party. They flew in from 29 Palms. I was back from Okinawa 4 days later. 4 days later, I was in Singapore getting on the ships. We were on the debark team, and that wasn't even the full Mew that was there. We didn't have the full 1-7. What we had was the advance party, and they were the ones providing us with security. They were up on the decks when we entered the Persian Gulf. I never got to see the lighted deck. After we got out of Singapore, we were down underneath. They were up top. They took care of that. We get into the Persian Gulf. We're on the ship, and it's hot as bananas because the water's so hot. It's making the whole ship hot. We got shot at by some pirates or some ships that were trying to interdict us, and the 50 cal teams from 1-7 are what helped repel all that. So it's a really fascinating when you think about that, that here General Mad Dog Man is telling a story, all documented in this book, and I come to find out, man, these are the same guys that I deployed with. I want to just tell you, at that time, and I was just talking about it, we'll come back after the break. I'll talk about it a little bit more if I can. This whole story leading to the deployment. My brother Dave's going to come on. He's going to tell you what he was doing, and we'll talk about the book a little bit. But in the meantime, check out Call Sign Chaos by Mad Dog Mattis. It's a great read.
Coming Saturday, March 30th, I'll be in person at the Red Hill VFW presenting for the first time in public my new book, Victory Over Chaos. You get to hear me tell the stories firsthand. You get to see the book and meet me in person. It'll be a great opportunity to do it. There's going to be live music immediately after. Dan Robbins, official, well-known and very popular in the area. You don't want to miss this event, an opportunity to support the VFW, our veterans, and of course, Project Chaos. That's Saturday, March 30th, 1600 hours. We'll be at the Red Hill VFW. That's in Red Hill, Pennsylvania, of course. I hope you can make it out. The event does not require a VFW membership and will be open to the general public. So mark your calendar for Saturday, March 30th. Invite a few friends and get ready for an exciting evening. See you there. If you've ever been to Center City, Philadelphia, you know that the Italian market is a huge draw down there. Some of the best local foods you can find anywhere on the planet. Well, I have good news for you. You don't have to go all the way down to Center City. Right here in Springhouse on Bethlehem Pike, a little-known secret to everybody except those of us that live here, Penna's Italian Market. I'm going to tell you right now, this is not a regular sandwich shop. You're going to want to try everything. They perfected the flavor of everything they offer. They have sandwiches, breakfast, lunch, and you can pick up your favorites, all made for you on the spot. But they also have carry-out food that you can take home. The best meatballs, chili you'll find anywhere. Soups, casseroles, anything you want, really. They even have a great place to sit down and eat. And if you're looking for a place to hold a meeting, they can accommodate that as well. It's a beautiful place, incredibly clean, well-presented. And I'm telling you, it's the best food you're going to find anywhere. The owner, Pete Penna, has painstakingly made sure that every little detail is perfect, and it shows in every bite. Trust me when I tell you, you won't regret stopping by. Penna's Italian Market. That's Penna's Italian Market in Springhouse on Bethlehem Pike, not far from the Fort Washington Interchange. Make sure you tell them that Chris sent you. It's not every day that you need a surveyor or civil engineer, but if you're in business, own property, or developing real estate, you know how critical it is to your project to make sure that you get the best. Everything has to be done correctly. It's important that those details are exact to ensure the success of the project. Well, my good friend Michael Tacanelli from STA Engineering is the best there is. It was my first job when I got home from the Marine Corps, working on a survey crew, while Michael back then was the party chief. We hit it off well because of his relentless, disciplined approach. It was something that I agreed with. And I learned a little bit about surveying, an ancient craft that's now done with modern tools, but it still requires a high level of skill and professional expertise. Michael and his team bring all three, skill, expertise, and of course, all the latest tools and technology. The entire package of surveying and engineering, allowing them to provide builders and developers, businesses, and property owners with reliable survey, design, and engineering for land development projects in southeastern Pennsylvania. For your next project, you're going to want to make sure you have the best possible support. Do yourself a favor and hire Michael Tacanelli, STA Engineering. They're already serving some of the area's largest developers, and they've done work in just about every municipality in the county. STA Engineering. Ask for Michael Tacanelli.
Here we are. We're back live on 860 AM WWDB. I'm going to bring my brother Dave on to talk about my new book, Victory Over Chaos. I'm here with my brother Michael Tacconelli in the studio right now. He's been a great contributor to the show, and he has had the privilege of meeting my brother Dave. Dave was the last one we saw coming out of the reunion from South Carolina back last May. And Dave was in my unit and a close brother of mine, and done a lot over the years with Dave, and just a guy that I've always looked up to. He's one of the good guys, I like to say. Dave, how you doing today? It's good to have you on the show. What'd you think of the book? We're not getting Dave.
Well, hey, Chris, I'm great. Thanks for having me.
What'd you think of the book, Dave?
Oh, the book was great. You know, it's 10 chapters. I read it twice, you know. Really enjoyed the flow of progression from your book. You know, in EMS, Emergency Medical Services, which I do part-time now, we try to paint the picture when we write a run report. And, you know, you did a great job painting the picture for this book. You know, every chapter, you know, you could kind of picture yourself there. You know, I can visualize what's happening in all the chapters of this book. It includes a lot of good language on the Marine Corps or jargon, you know, which you do a good job of explaining for the non-vet. Your chapters, you know, bring out your personality as an author. Also highlights, you know, the lifestyles, you know, of a basic Marine, you know, at least on the front lines anyway. You keep the reader wanting more. As you finish up the book, you know, you describe the Marine Corps from the standing point, you know, of the indomitable spirit and the USMC, you know, living on forever. You know, I think kids should read this book, you know, just for a better understanding of what vets go through and see, you know. It should be in schools, Chris. You know, and that's my thought on the book.
Wow.
It was a great read.
You know, I guess I'm speechless, Dave. That was incredible. Thank you so much, my brother. That means a lot, man. And Dave was there. I just want to make it clear. I want to talk about those details in a second, because we did not have the exact same vantage point. I think people would be fascinated to hear some of that. I was, when I reached out to Dave, I was telling him the importance of this book selling. I mean, we've got a radio show revolving around it. We got a lot going on. I said, man, I really need you to lay on the sales pitch. Dave's from Iowa. He's a good old boy out there, a country boy. He doesn't get involved in a lot of sales. Dave, I think you just created a new career, brother. That was incredible. I think we got to make a video of that. That's better than what I could have done. I appreciate it. It's put a lot. I wanted it to be a story that properly told the story. While I acknowledge that it's my own perspective, right? There's going to be different perspectives and maybe some details or whatever that people want to discuss, and that's fine. But I wanted to capture the essence of who we were, what we did. And Dave, I don't know if you remember down at that reunion, it was Sergeant Major Suarez. Remember, he got up and he said, 30 years in the Marine Corps, and there was never a unit like as great as Alpha Battery. Do you remember him saying that?
Oh, absolutely. Yep. And all his time in, he said we were absolutely the best unit. And, you know, he remembers faces more than any other unit. Yep, absolutely.
It's incredible, right, that a guy has that kind of a career. 30 years in the Marine Corps, goes all the way to the E-9, the highest enlisted rank, and the one unit that he remembers. So when we left there, it was one of the things that encouraged me to write the book. And I'll just say right now, just to give credit where credit is due, is my brother Michael here that told me, you got to write the book down. And he had to tell me a couple times because I was being a little obstinate, if you can imagine. I'm never usually like that, but in that case, I was. Hey, speaking of which, Dave.
You know, I was going to say, you know, I met Mike, and you need to listen to him more often, I think. You know, he's a good guy.
Let's stick with the book, Dave. I appreciate your comments, all right? oh, man, that's too funny. That's great stuff. So I was going to ask you, Dave. So first of all, where were you when COFGE was going on?
So, you know, my day was kind of divided up. You know, obviously I was with the battery out in the desert with you. But my day was kind of divided up between the ant farm, because Matt was out there by himself. And then I was on Gun 8 a lot, helping them when we'd land in a pause and start setting up. And then I was also, you know, running a lot of chow and ammo, kind of like you.
That's right. Weren't you the guy? You got us the yeast. Didn't you get us the yeast from the chow hall? Wasn't that you?
Yeah, but don't tell anybody it's important.
Dave, it's been like 30 years. I don't think they're going to come get us over it. I'm not going to tell the story right now. That'll be the little teaser. There's a chapter, Water into Wine. If you're interested in finding that out, it's fantastic. I wasn't sure when I wrote the book that it was you, Dave, after I put it all together. So let me just explain this so everybody kind of understands a little bit, just so where we were. I don't know if it'll make complete sense, but at least it'll add a little perspective to it. So we were 8-gun battery, and with those 8-gun batteries, 2 platoons, was 4 guns and 4 guns. Sometimes they could be spread out. I mean, what do you think the biggest pause, Dave? Sometimes it'd be like a half mile spread out, I think, between all the guns, would you say?
Yeah, oh, definitely, yeah. Yep, it was quite a walk from gun 1 to gun 8.
Yeah, so you were like, because I really don't remember seeing you a lot out on the gun line. That explains why. And I wasn't sure. So when you were on the gun line, and I want to get to this story you told about Rourke. I was a little surprised when you, the reason I asked all that, I was trying to figure out how he was driving and not you. But let me just make sure I explain this so everybody understands. When Dave talks about the ant farm, it's the antenna farm. It's a communications center. Matt, who our brother Matt, who is down in Washington, D.C. right now, is on the National Finance Committee for the VFW, if you can believe that. And he's a great guy for the job. But anyway, Dave was out there keeping Matt company because Matt doesn't like to get lonely. We won't get into that. And then when you weren't doing that, when you weren't holding Matt's hand, you were over on gun 8. The photograph I have of me and you over there, I believe we were at the ant farm. That's partly why I was asking. I was wondering how the heck we got out there. But anyway, so Dave is on the other side of the planet from me. Could have been a half a mile away. And then also, we were driving in different circles. And that was that Dave was doing more of a comm headquarters support, and I was running ammo. Did you ever run ammo at all, Dave? Did you ever go with us in the ammo train?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I went a couple times. Just kind of depended on, you know, what was going on for the day. Like I said, a lot of times I was the one hauling chow, running back to the mess hall.
To the rear. You were back in the rear with the gear. I should have suspected. I should have known. I'm kidding, Dave. Hey.
Yeah, you got your yeet.
Yeah, I did indeed. We all benefited from that. That's a whole story in itself, right? So, all right. So, Kafji, obviously you read the book, so you know what my account of it is. Why don't you walk through your account?
So, you know, what I remember about Kafji, you know, I was only an E3, so I didn't know much as far as, you know, the planning and the stuff that the guys in FBC and some of the, you know, higher ups would know. You know, I remember getting on the Pacific Coast Highway, and at that day, I was actually on an ammo truck with Rourke, and it was kind of weird because my truck had broken down, and Rourke had been driving this truck, and he was an ammo tech, and although I was Motor T, he didn't really want to go up on the ring mount on where the 50 cal was. So I was like, oh, yeah, let's rock and roll. So I was like, so I jumped up. Did a weapons check and, you know, stayed up there with a great view of us, you know, kind of entering towards the whole Kafji area. And, you know, what I remember really, you know, were just tracers flying all over the place. You know, this is at night. And it wasn't long, you know, so we're going one way. And all of a sudden we start meeting all these military vehicles heading the wrong directions. I mean, because we're heading towards the fight. We're like,
were you on the highway at that point with the vehicles coming the other direction?
Yeah.
Were we moving as a battery movement?
Yeah. Yep. We're going as a unit. Yep. We're all moving then. Yep. So, you know, and of course, eventually we pulled off the highway. We set up the pause. And you know, and it seemed like, of course, air power was.
Let me just, Dave, interrupt you 1 second on this, because this is a moment that really needs to be captured here, brother, that I did not realize. I do not remember driving into those headlights, and I think there may be a reason why I may not have been at that specific spot. But the fact that it happened, I need to explain what happened. Most people have heard me tell the story. We're there in the Saudi sector providing fire support to the Arab coalition forces. That's it. We weren't really supposed to be engaging in any fire. The Iraqis came down acting with 3 Iraqi mechanized divisions. This is a huge force, far larger than anything we had in the sector. They came down like they were going to surrender, turn their turrets around, and attack the city. When they did, the forces that we were there to support, they turned and ran and deserted us, turned on their headlights and literally just ran out of there. In the meantime, 2 Army teams and 2 Marine teams got trapped inside the city. I've told this story a few times now, and it's crazy, really, what went on that night. But, I, you know, imagine now for a second, just to see how clear this imagery is, While the rest of the coalition forces are headed south on that highway with their headlights on, we were going north into the fire with our headlights off. Pick it up from there, Dave.
Okay, yeah, so we had our night lights on, basically, you know, a small little dim light that you drive by. So we're heading north. All these vehicles are, of course, they're lighting us up just, you know, with headlights and stuff. And they're zooming by us and we're heading north and, you know, everybody's like, what in the world's going on? Why aren't they, you know, turning around and fighting? Especially when we knew that, you know, we had teams inside of Kochi. And, so like I said, we're heading towards the fight and they weren't. We eventually, you know, we pull off the highway, we set up a pause. And I think that's, you know, air power is flying over us. And I think at one point, that's when everybody, you know, we all lowered our tubes and it just in preparation for close combat. But of course, that never happened. We never had to fire that close.
Dave, let me tell you this story real quick. And I hate to keep interrupting you, but this is huge.
Oh, that's no problem.
So that story of the lowering the tubes, I was just talking about that with my brother Michael here before we got started. I recently came across an interview, a video I watched, with a dark green colonel from the LAV regiment that was in front of us. They got hit hard. He talks about the whole story. They got hit by Iraqi APCs. They were outnumbered like 3-1, and they actually were able to stop them. They actually repelled that assault. I have a funny feeling that they were what stopped what was headed our way. It was a crazy night. But anyway, keep going. We lowered the tubes. What happened from there? What do you remember?
So, you know, we lowered the tubes. Like I said, we never had to fire with the close combat. But I don't think it was long after that, you know, when we started having some fire missions into Kochi. So, you know, we dug in, you know, we dug the spades in. You know, the gun guys did their things, you know, ammo guys did our things. And I from there, it gets kind of gray.
Yeah.
I think at that point I was just, you know, we're so tired that, you know, your muscle memory kicks in. And, you know, I think we shot in that morning. I don't really remember much after that.
Yeah, we were pretty beat up. I talk about that in the book, if you remember. And I'll tell you what was going on. The weeks leading up to that, you know, the news reports were that the air campaign had started. That started like January 1, early after New Year's. But Kochi didn't happen until the 29th of January. And even then, American news was not reporting that a ground war had started because there was no ground offensive, which is fair enough, I suppose. Just one small problem. There was a ground offensive going on. Do you remember every night we were taking incoming from the Iraqi artillery before that? Do you remember that, Dave?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we were going up, seemed like midnight, 2 o'clock in the morning. We'd go up to a certain area, fire off, you know, I don't know, 4 to 8 rounds, load up and get the heck out of there before they fired back.
Yep. You're talking about two different things. We would get hit. And then at one point, finally, we would sneak up to the border. Imagine doing this in the desert. It's an amazing sight. And we were very proficient at it. Take the whole battery, blackout driving with our night vision on. We would sneak up as close to the border as we could. Because their artillery was longer range than ours. They were just out of range. So they weren't hitting us because they couldn't hit the broadside of a barn, but they were making it down to where we were at. And we would go sneak up to the border to light them up. But, yeah, we'd been fighting for a few weeks by the time Kochi hit. And I don't know if you remember, Dave, it was about that same time we went down to one meal a day. And so, you know, pickings were getting a little slim out there, and we were pretty far out there. It wasn't like we could just, you know, run back to the general store and pick up a few things. There was none. You said in the storyline, talk about that being up in that turret with Rourke. What did you see? Rourke's
okay,
driving.
So,
you're on the turret with a 50 cal. And what do you see?
Yep. So I'm at a great point of view as far as seeing things. And, you know, we're probably, 5-6 miles out. And the tracer rounds in Kochi are just flying everywhere. I mean, they're zinging all over. And that was probably the time when I was like, okay, this is real now. It's time to get, you know, time to get serious. That's basically what I saw. And then, you know, you'd see, you know, or you'd hear the air power going over. When I was actually on the turn, the truck was moving. I didn't hear it then because the truck was too loud. But once we stopped in the desert, and set up the pods, then you could definitely hear the air power going over. But no, on the mound itself, it was just like the 4th of July, 4 miles ahead.
Armageddon, man. 4th of July. That's a great way to put it, I guess. Hey, Dave, we got to get going here. We got a break coming up. I wanted to bring you on and talk about the book. You did a great job, my brother. I can't thank you enough. And I appreciate you sharing some of the story about Kafji. And it was really proud for me to be there with me, be there with you, rather. And you've always been a great Marine and a great brother. And it was great to see you last year. I can't wait to see you again. I just have one question here before we let you go here, before the break. Would you do it again?
Oh, absolutely, yes. I talk about my military experience quite a bit. In fact, my son must have heard it enough where, you know, he's in the ROTC program with the Marine Corps option. So he's heading that direction himself.
Oh, God bless you. Hopefully your daughter stays away. I got to run, my brother. I love you. I'll talk to you soon. Have a great day. And when we come back, we're going to get into this interview with James Bradley. It is absolutely epic. You don't want to miss this. Coming back, interview with James Bradley. We'll see you there. Noticed I never talk about social media? Kind of amazing, don't you think? Who in today's age is not on social media? Well, in my opinion, it's not very social, and I think it's a big waste of time, money, and a whole bunch of other problems. Either way, I'm set out on a mission to prove that we don't need social media or big tech to promote a business. Well, that presents a little problem, of course, given that most businesses are promoted on social media and big tech. But there are other methods, and one of the most effective we found for getting the word out about the radio show is big, beautiful, custom-made magnets that you can put on your car. I kid you not, especially if you're a veteran. These magnets are so cool. The imagery taken from my new book, Victory Over Chaos, works as a perfect backdrop. I hope you'll consider getting one and putting it on your car. It's literally the best thing you could do right now to support this show. You can get them at projectchaos.org/store. You can check it out. There's a big, beautiful photo right there at projectchaos.org. Go to the store and check out the car magnets. They're amazing, and you'd be doing a lot to help the show. I'm asking you personally, if you can, it would mean a lot to me. Go to projectchaos.org/store and get the car magnet and put it on your car. I'm very excited to announce that coming Saturday, March 30th, I'll be in person at the Red Hill VFW presenting for the first time in public my new book, Victory Over Chaos. You get to hear me tell the stories firsthand. You get to see the book and meet me in person. It'll be a great opportunity to do it. There's going to be live music immediately after. Dan Robbins, official, well-known and very popular in the area. You don't want to miss this event, an opportunity to support the VFW, our veterans, and of course, Project Chaos. That's Saturday, March 30th, 1600 hours. We'll be at the Red Hill VFW. That's in Red Hill, Pennsylvania, of course. I hope you can make it out. The event does not require a VFW membership and will be open to the general public. So mark your calendar for Saturday, March 30th. Invite a few friends and get ready for an exciting evening. See you there. Very excited when I reached out to James and he agreed to accept the invitation to come on the show. As I said before me, this is an iconic moment to speak to the son of somebody who raised the flag at Iwo Jima. What I didn't know when I reached out to him initially is that I had no idea the level of celebrity that James Bradley is, quite frankly. He's going to tell you the story of in this interview that you're about to hear, but he had some involvement with President Bush Sr. Wait till you hear the story. It's absolutely blow your mind. And I got to tell you, I'm so excited to be the one to bring it to you. But without any further ado, please welcome a man who is as big a hero as any Marine on Iwo Jima, in my mind, James Bradley. He brought this story to the world in a way that we wouldn't have if it weren't for him, the son of Navy Corpsman John Henry Bradley. James Bradley wrote the book on Iwo Jima. It's called Flags of Our Fathers, an incredible account, incredible testimony, and incredible writing. This incredible book was later turned into a movie created by Steven Spielberg and Clint Eastwood. James went on to write three other books, The China Mirage, The Empirical Cruise, and The Flyboys. All true stories, secret history unveiled, revealing true stories of courage. James does a great job capturing the essence of our nation's finest warriors. He's just finishing his fourth book. He's been working on from Vietnam for 10 years now. Get a sense of the dedication that he has to the craft. Please visit jamesbradley.com where you can check out his books. And, of course, they're available at all major resellers. Just look for James Bradley.
But you're going to want to do yourself a favor. Take a look at the books that James Bradley has to offer. You will find yourself on a journey like no other. I read his book, and the quality of the work is as good, if not better, than Jack Carr and certainly Stephen King. And the best part is it's the truth. Please welcome James Bradley. James Bradley, great to have you here this morning. Your father, John Henry Bradley, was one of the original flag raisers on Iwo Jima. And there's a lot I want to ask you about this. These are some big shoes that you have to fill. But before we get into all that, why don't you tell us a little bit about your father, what kind of father he was, and what kind of relationship you had with him before the book? Obviously, you wrote the book after he had passed. But tell us a little bit about your father and how you got along with him, what your relationship was like.
You know, when I was 5 years old, I remember sitting in the barber's chair. Remember those boards they put across the arms for the little boys?
Yes.
And I was sitting on whatever you call that, a little bumper board. And on the wall straight in front of me was a calendar with the flag raising on Iwo Jima. And the barber, boy, your dad is a great man. Your dad is a great man. But that's not who my dad was. He was disconnected from that. You know, in the 1960s and 70s, we didn't talk a lot about World War II and as a society. And, you know, there was Hogan's Heroes and Gomer Pyle, USMC. The real Greatest Generation stuff didn't start until these guys started talking in their 70s, which was in the 1990s. So my dad was a guy. He was a funeral director. He had 8 kids. He had a gorgeous wife. We had a big house. We had a cottage. We had dogs, cats, and he was a guy. And if you had happened to, an insurance man came from out of town to an investment meeting my dad was a member of, and he says, oh, you're Mr. Bradley who raised the flag on Iwo Jima. And my dad said, yes, that was a long time ago.
Let me ask you on a slightly different angle. If I got the story right, maybe I didn't. If I didn't, correct me if I'm wrong. But you had to get in touch with some Marine officers to help get you and your family down to the island. Did I read that right?
Commandant Krulak took us there. I went down to see the commandant, and I said I'd like to take my mother to Iwo Jima. And he slapped the table, and he looked at his aides and he said, Mrs. Bradley's going to Iwo Jima.
I had a feeling you were going to say that, and that's why I brought it up. I want to tell you a little story real quick, and I think it represents who you are, which is why I said that. You know, you walked in there to the commandant. I've never met the commandant. I spent 4 years active duty, and I'm not sure if I called the commandant even today. We're going to find out here because I actually need to talk to him, the current commandant. But for you to call down, he says, come on down. You come. So I want to go to Iwo Jima. He says, let's go. Because there's that much of a commitment to the men who were there. That's what the meaning of Semper Fidelis. It's just an incredible bond. I'm so happy to hear that the Marine Corps treated you and your family that way. At least one little thing that we could do for you. Let me ask you this, with all this talk. Do you believe the battle was necessary? Did your father support the war after everything that he had been through?
Well, no, it wasn't necessary. It was absolutely critical. If you look at a map, I mean, Paul Tibbetts flew the Enola Gay that dropped the atom bomb in Hiroshima. And Paul Tibbetts told me to his face, you know, we rendezvoused over Mount Suribachi. All the planes circled Mount Suribachi on their way to Hiroshima.
So you know the incredible burden that you carry with all this. Do you feel that? Does that ever affect you?
No, I, you know, I risk carpal tunnel syndrome, you know, I mean, I didn't do anything like in terms of risking anything. And I just interviewed a bunch of guys and they were like my dad, they didn't want to talk. So I said, you know, only 22 guys went up the hill. So this wasn't like I had to track down thousands and, you know, and you can look on one piece of paper. There's Joe and Harry and Larry and, you know, 22 guys went up. So I'm talking to these guys, the survivors, and one of them, you know, your dad didn't talk, James, and I'm the same way, and I'm sure you can understand. I said, yes, sir, Mr. Jones, I can understand. I said, do you mind if I keep in contact and just tell you what others are telling me? No, 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 no. So I'd call him like every 3 weeks, let's say, and say, you know, Larry told me this and great. So on the third one, I thought I'll make my move. And I said, you know, Mr. Jones, I think you're not talking to me because an 18-year-old friend of yours died and you're afraid to cry. And I said, listen to me. I said, you're 75. You're on your way out. If you don't talk, it's like that 18-year-old died for nothing. Nobody is going to know his story because you didn't want to cry. I said, you talk to me. And he said, James, call me tomorrow at 1. So the next day I called him. Later, I learned he had shot his wife out of the house. He tells me this horrific story that's in the movie and in the book about his friend dying. And at the end, he says, James, that's all I can say. And he hangs up the phone. And my keyboard is full of water. Well, Flyboys is too unbelievable. They were eating, you know, it's about eating the enemy. And George Bush gets away. They were going to put him in the pot and eat him.
Connected, you know, history spanning a couple of different presidents. You've had access to some of the highest people in the country, and you speak about it so casually. And you've uncovered the true story of something that is one of the most remarkable events in modern human history, James. It's a really incredible work that you've done.
It's like I say, it's picking up the, I mean, you know, hey, President Bush, you know, I mean, I'll tell you a story about Bush. So I get this information and I write to him at his library. Hey, Mr. President, you have to talk to me because I got this information. So I get a polite letter back. James, I read Flags of Our Fathers, love the book. I can't talk to you because my son is just got elected and I'm not talking to Reader's Digest, New York Times. You know, I can't talk to you because I told everybody I'm not going to give interview. So I write to him, well, Mr. President, I don't care. You have to talk to me because these guys, these other George Bushes got killed and you have to talk to me. They got shot down right where you did. And you got to talk to me because you're part of the story. I mean, it's not like you got to talk to me. You got to talk for these guys. So he writes me 7 letters telling me why he can't talk to me. So by happenstance, on Pearl Harbor Day, we're both invited to go to Fredericksburg, Texas, to the Museum of the Pacific and give a speech. I'm the opening speaker and George Bush is the big speaker. Well, there's 4,000 people there. And we're in, and you know, we're backstage waiting for Bush, and Bush shows up, 7 limousines, people jump out. Bush is 6 foot, you know, Bush is taller than Reagan. Bush is an enormous guy. And George Bush comes. Well, I used to be in the meetings business. I used to coach corporate speakers. So folks listening to this, what does every speaker do before they go on stage to give a speech?
What do they do?
They take a pee. They take a pee. So I got myself last in line. Someone would get behind me and I'd say, no, come on, in front of me. I made sure I was last in line. And then he comes down the line shaking hands and, you know, oh, good to meet you. Good to meet you. Good. And I say, hey, Mr. President, James Bradley, Flags of Our Fathers. Oh, James. Yeah, we've been communicating. I said, Mr. President, you need to go to the head. Yeah. I said, it's right here. I had sussed it out. So the Secret Service couldn't follow us into the can. So we're standing at the urinal and I had to rehearse. Hey, Mr. President, you got shot down in this bay and Floyd Hall got shot down 2 months earlier and the Japanese took him and they did this and that. And then you got rescued and da, da, da. Doesn't say a thing. We go over to wash our hands, 2 separate things. And he's washing. And then I got another pitch, you know, Mr. President, you got shot down here, but this guy did this. And I went back and I found this guy who saw you and doesn't say a thing. He walks out of the restroom. I open the door. The crowd is there. And I thought, I am a dope. I cornered the president in the can and he didn't even say anything.
I think it's awesome.
So 7 days later, I'm doing what every author is excited about, watching paper come out of my printer, you know, completely boring day. Phone rings. Hello, James. This is George Bush.
Can you believe that story? What a guy. I want to just take a second here. I'll get into the meat of this and then we'll move on. You know, for me to sit and spend an hour with that, we actually spent an hour and a half. I recorded an hour of it. We cut that off and we spent another 30 minutes having a candid conversation. 2 guys, him in Vietnam, me on the East Coast. What are the chances of this? And do you realize the value of that interview for this radio show and what we're doing here? It's huge, huge. But for me personally, just to sit and talk with a guy like that, sit and talk in the same language. It's just I really can't even put it into words. And the impact of what he did with that book, and then to come do this interview with us, really, it's historical on some level, memorializing what occurred at Iwo Jima in a way that really hasn't been brought public before. And I thought it was an interesting perspective that he brought. Really amazing guy. Definitely worth getting into his other books, by the way. JamesBradley.com is his website. Indicated that, and I actually ordered his other book, Flyboys, that he was talking about there, and he indicated he might come back on the show. So we might be able to hear from him again, which would really be an opportunity as well. And I thought the funniest part of that was him cornering George Bush Sr. there, really funny. But there was something that wasn't so funny that he said that I want to talk about. And it really speaks to the heart of what we're doing here at Project Chaos. Do we love our veterans? I'll just ask the question right now. Of course we do. Why do we love our veterans? Why is it so important? Because our veterans love our country. Our veterans love our country so much that they're willing to pay it forward all the way up to including the price of their very lives. Can you imagine that? What does that mean? It means that young Marines like the Marines of 1-7 pack up and go away advance party somewhere. They don't even know where they're going when they're coming back. And they do it without questioning anything because they can't. They'll go load up into some tin can, get shipped halfway around the world to do what? They have no idea. The most heinous things you could ever imagine, but they do it willingly. They never question. They want to be in the fight, and we need them in the fight. So what am I getting at? When I talked to James Bradley for the half hour after the interview was over, he said something to me. He said, Chris, I want you to understand, I be honest with you, I didn't really have a full perspective history on Iwo Jima until this came up. You know, I knew it was a thing. I knew about the what occurred there, of course. It was very important to me. It was a huge symbol for us as Marines, tenacity, really, and what we're designed to do. Go march up the hill, and if it means dying, it means dying. But you're going to get in the fight. You're going to stay in the fight. It's where we wanted to be. But I didn't know all the details. And I certainly didn't know that of the flag raisers, that only three of them even came home alive. James Bradley said to me, he said, you know, 84% of the unit was wiped out. I never really processed it until I thought about that. I thought, let me take my Alpha Battery photo and cross out all of them except like 10. How would I feel about that? I suspect it would change my perspective a little bit for sure. They saw and dealt with a lot. Heinous, really, what they dealt with. But let me tell you what James Bradley told me, why I get a little upset. James Bradley said to me, as we're talking through, and I think he could get that there was some details that I wasn't aware of, that I'd never been there, he's been there, what do I know? He says to me, Chris, for those Marines that were attacking Iwo Jima, it was like, imagine you're attacking the Washington Monument, right? You know what the Washington Monument is? It's this straight up column, right? Super high in the air. Imagine you got to attack the Washington Monument, and inside of it are 2,000 armed fighters shooting at you. How would you undertake that operation? Well, let me explain it to you. It was done successfully throughout the Pacific. It was not coordinated properly on Iwo Jima. And maybe it's part of the reason why James' dad didn't want to talk about it. The naval gunfire support wasn't adequate. There's accounts of that. Of course, it gets brushed under the carpet. The tanks couldn't get on the beach. And the bottom line is that these guys are out in the wide open trying to take a hill. It's impossible. 23,000 Marines, just like the young Marines that I was on that boat with, 23,000 of them died before they finally figured out that we need to change the approach on this. Once they laid down the proper preparatory fire, guess what? That is what enabled those Marines to take the hill. I'm not taking anything away from their tenacity. For God's sake, they paid such a price for it. But they didn't have the support that they needed. Now, it was a million years ago. It's over and done with. I agree. We're not going to sit here and shed a tear about it. What's the point of arguing about it? We won. We did. And thank God we did. James explained all that. But what? Let's not do it again. Why do we have our military putting those Marines right back in the same position? And then they're going to come out, oh, we're going to have a literal regiment and stand-in forces and all these crazy new terms for ways of saying that you're not going to have the fire support that you need. I think we need to do a better job of listening to people like Mad Dog Mattis. What an incredible book that he wrote. Thank you, James Bradley, for your contribution. Really amazing. Incredible man. Let me switch gears. I talked about call sign chaos at General Mattis. We're going to run out of time. Let me tell you what he said about perspective. He said, history presents many examples of militaries that forgot that their purpose was to fight and win. So long as we live in an imperfect world, one containing enemies of democracy, some of them live right here, I'll remind you, we will need a military strictly committed to combat effectiveness. Our liberal democracy must be protected by a bodyguard of lethal warriors, organized, trained, and equipped to kill. My words, he said dominate in battle. But if you do not have men specifically trained to kill, there's going to be a security problem. And what did I say a couple weeks ago? Last week maybe it was. If it's not secure, you don't own it, at least not for long. General Mattis talked about his perspective on the Marine Corps. He said, for me, direct leadership was all about preparing my troops to win in close quarters combat. I can't tell you how much time we spent on that training. When you go into battle, you enter a different world. I set out to ingrain in every grunt an aggressive spirit with confidence in winning. Whatever we learn to do, we learn by actually doing it. That's it for today. I had a couple other things we could have talked about. We'll have to get to it another time. It's been a great day. Thanks for listening. It was a lot of history that we covered. Thank you so much to the sound engineers here at WWDB. We appreciate the support and the great work. And thank you to Beasley Media for hosting us. We'll see you back next week. Don't forget to visit ProjectChaos.org.